of the Mud Puppy Games Network.
Welcome to Designers and Discourses, a podcast in which we interview tabletop game designers and discuss their influences and inspirations. In tonight's episode, we talk to James Edward Radji IV, creator of Lamentations of the Flame Princess.
Tonight's guest is game designer James Edward Radji IV, the author and creator of Lamentations of the Flame Princess, a weird fantasy role-playing game. Originally published in 2010, Lamentations of the Flame Princess is much more than just another open game license twist on the world's most popular role-playing game. In an effort to share the style of his own campaign with the world, James drew from some unusual influences when creating Lamentations, from death metal music to underground horror movies to explicit album cover art. Tonight we're going to talk to James about all this and more. And James, thank you so much for joining me.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Very excited to have you on the show, and I will lead off with a quick shout out to Joe Bittman, who put us two crazy kids together. Thanks, Joe.
Yes, thank you. And in a month or two, the entire world will be thanking Job as well.
That's right.
That Towers 2 thing is finally going to come out, and oh boy, is nobody going to be happy with that.
Well, I have some insight being friends with Job. I have my guess of which directions he would take it cut loose in your universe.
Yeah, I mean, I don't want to reveal any of the inside baseball secrets of the podcast, but, you know, I happen to have gotten from a little birdie some heads up about what some of the conversation's going to be, and all of the stuff that you know, well, not all of the stuff, some of the stuff we're going to talk about as far as influences and, you know, me being, you know, not family friendly, Job, he turns all of that up to 15. Forget 11, he goes all the way to 15. So I'm really looking forward to how people don't like that. So,
let's start with the basics. Though you've been playing role-playing games since the early 80s, the brand name for your game and setting, Lamentations of the Flame Princess, actually comes from an earlier music fanzine that you did. Is that right?
Yes.
So what made you carry that name over as a brand to your game system?
It was just the name I published under, and I saw no reason to change the name just because I was changing what I was publishing. I suppose I'm glad I didn't go into school textbook publishing, because that would look weird on the back. But yeah, that's the name I publish under. I really don't consider any sort of real separation between me and the Lamentations of the Flame Princess name. So I was doing music stuff, now I'm doing role-playing stuff, and it really nothing has changed as far as why I would have the name or not. So, I mean, Lamentations of the Flame Princess, it does sound like a role-playing kind of name.
It certainly does.
Yeah, luckily I didn't start off with some, you know, really hardcore death metal kind of fanzine, you know, called Anal Prolapse or something. That wouldn't have carried over, you know, Anal Prolapse role-playing, you know, that wouldn't have gone anywhere.
Oh, Lord.
Luckily, I was into some of the more pretentious European stuff in the 90s and wanted to fit in with that, so Lamentations of the Flame Princess fits in as a fanzine name, and, you know, that was something that's able to just carry over to role-playing. Lamentations of the Flame Princess. Yeah, that's some crap somebody would name an adventure, so yeah.
James, I don't want you to feel like you have to censor yourself in any way.
Oh, don't worry. I was going to make you censor me if you had to, you know, put bleeps over this later. So,
yeah, wrong podcast. We don't do that on this podcast. But you were writing and publishing adventures prior to Lamentations of the Flame Princess, but then at some point decided to create your own system. Can you walk us through why that was?
Yeah, really, in 2009, I started writing adventures under my own official business name imprint. I'd previously done some unofficial, almost fanzine-style things.
Huge fan of Esoteric Creature Generator, by the way.
A random esoteric creature generated for classic fantasy role-playing games and their modern simulacra. If you're going to be a huge fan, get it right.
Oh, that's a mouthful for me, but yes, that.
That was an interesting experience because I published that, spring, summer 2008. Didn't intend for it to really be anything but going down to the copy shop and running off some copies, and I mailed copies to other people that were doing retro clone kind of things, and Goodman was one of the companies doing those, you know, first edition adventures, and then he comes back with, hey, I'd like to put this out for real in stores. Now it's like, okay.
Twist my arm.
Yeah. So the first thing I ever tried, I got a publishing deal out of, and I was like, ha! I might be good at this. But what happened was, when I started the official business in 2009, I put out some adventures. Death Frost Doom was a lucky break at being the first thing I put out. That seems to have impacted people a bit. But it's really hard, really, 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 really hard to get taken seriously, to really get attention, get market penetration, get media exposure, such as it is in the role-playing scene, when you're just making adventures for systems which themselves kind of have a knockoff kind of reputation about them, especially in that time. You know, 2008, 2009, the whole OSR thing wasn't really established as part of the mainstream of gaming yet. It was this sub-corner of, you know, niche of a niche, and, you know, people kept saying that. So I decided from the start I wanted to make a go at this. I wanted to make a living doing this. And just doing the adventures, I caught on after about 6 months that this wasn't going to get me to where I needed to be. So I needed to make a game, you know, have an actual game under the brand name to be the spearhead to get the adventures into stores, to get the attention, to get people talking. You had to have a game. And so I can't say I threw something together, but it was, I don't even remember what that had. There were three, okay, let me speak coherently. So far, three editions of the game, basically. The first one, the deluxe edition. Second one is the Grindhouse edition, and then there's the Rules and Magic hardcover, which is basically the Grindhouse rules with a new firearm section attached to it. And I don't really remember. I know this is horrible for a podcast that's all about game design. I remember my evolution as to how I changed things and why I changed things, but at what point in which publications the changes were actually published, that I'm a little fuzzy on, and I do apologize for that.
No apology necessary, because I totally get it. I will be playtesting Mutant Crawl Classics, the game I've written, and my own players are quoting rules back to me that I've gotten wrong, and I'm just like, hey, just because I wrote these rules doesn't mean I have them all memorized.
Yeah, but the deluxe edition, that had the bunch of stuff. That had graph paper and hex paper and a pencil and the dice and two adventures were in there, but the rules themselves weren't all that different than the standard OGL kind of thing running around, because I wasn't thinking of Lamentations as being the rule set. The rule set was just a vehicle for all the other stuff I wanted to do. But as it happens, people will really start fixating on the rules. And they'll think that the rules and your main set is what the company is and does. So when that box set sold out fairly quickly, decided for the Grindhouse edition that I really needed to emphasize how I was different and make my mark that way in the actual rules. So then the Grindhouse edition is what really started the artwork and really getting the horror and the metal and getting that imagery into the rules.
Well, you have touched on a very important point that I want to address, and that's that as the OSR was beginning to evolve, there was the games came out in waves. So the first wave of OGL games, like Labyrinth Lord and Swords and Wizardry, were all simulations and representations of older editions, as intended. But then the second wave of OGL games came out, like Dungeon Crawl Classics and Castles and Crusades, that were reinventing portions of the games and were really their own games. And Lamentations of Flame Princess would be in that second wave, right?
Well, yeah, Castles and Crusades, that first comes out in 2004, I think it was. And then Osric was 2006, Labyrinth Lord 2007, if I've got my times correct. I think the important divisions are more what's supposed to be really faithful to the old stuff and what's not so much.
What's its own game?
Yeah, I mean, well, Osric and Labyrinth Lord, you know, work as their own games, but they are very, very, very close by complete intentional design to earlier versions of Dungeons and Dragons. And, you know, that's the intention, and I think they are actually useful for several reasons. Number one, at the time, D&D stuff wasn't in print at all. The old D&D stuff, the 70s and 80s.
Before Wizards cut everything loose in PDF form.
Yeah, so the stuff had been available in PDF, and then they pulled it, and then... But basically, if you wanted new stuff in print that didn't have people's coffee stains and urine smells on them, these were the way... You know, these retro clones or simulacra, whatever you want to call them, they were the way to get new stuff that was the game really and honestly better formatted and laid out than the old editions were, and they were vehicles for doing new stuff. Now, as time goes on, with the new waves of the games that aren't trying to just continued the exact flavor and legacy of old Dungeons and Dragons, things like Osric and Labyrinth Lord still have tremendous value because, well, number one, people are branching out and doing different things, and lots of people do still want that old classic D&D flavor, so here these things still are. And the name Dungeons and Dragons itself doesn't mean any one thing anymore. If you say Dungeons and Dragons, you have to specify an edition. Sometimes you have to specify a setting because Ravenloft is going to play a lot different than Planescape or Spelljammer. So if you say, oh, I want to play D&D, it doesn't say much. But if you say, let's play Labyrinth Lord, that's a very specific thing. There's not a lot more explaining you need to do. So the fact that, you know, early on, people complained Labyrinth Lord was a copy. Well, these days, it has a very, you know, very distinct reputation, a very distinct niche in itself, because it is the thing that no one else is doing anymore, and even the brand name that it quote-unquote copied off of isn't that thing anymore. So Labyrinth Lord means something as a name and a concept by itself. And, you know, I would hope that's what I want Lamentations to be, Lamentations of the Flame Princess to be its own concept and thing, no matter how derivative or not the rules are. And I would hope that everyone else that's doing their own style, their own game in this style, in this scene, are hoping for that same individuality in their own game or brand or however you want to call it.
Well, for clarity, I mean, because whenever you label something, you've now made it binary, and that's not my exact intention, because a lot of what we're talking about is just where the slider bars are on the soundboard.
But at the same time, just in the clone games, there are over 100 of them out there. There's got to be the two, you know, the one-line pitch that you give someone. Sure, all of them are going to have more going on under the surface. There are going to be the differences done for personal preference or copyright issue reasons. Everything is going to be different. Everything has more to talk about. But essentially, with over 100 games just in this one corner of the role-playing scene, let alone everything else happening in role-playing, past and present, I think there is value in just recognizing and having simple little labels to go with something.
Well, and then in the sense of labels, then, whereas Labyrinth Lord, you could you could easily classify as a retro clone. I want to get back to Lamentations. Games like Dungeon Crawl Classics and Lamentations of the Flame Princess are not technically retro clones. Would you agree with that?
You see, that's tough because Dungeon Crawl Classics makes everything more unique and different. Nothing seems to be a direct rip off of the old stuff. Lamentations, I found no reason to recreate the wheel on a lot of the elements of the game. So it is, you know, straight out of the open game content because it's done. It's there. It's easy. I don't want to change it. It doesn't need to be changed. So there it is. Why mess with it?
You've made it your own, and we'll get to some of those particulars. But
I have made some changes, and maybe I'll make more in the future. And I've added my own stuff. But essentially, nobody reads the Lamentations rulebook and looks at the words and the mechanics and thinks, "Oh, this is all so original and crazy." You know, that's not where the innovation and the unique qualities of Lamentations. They don't lie in the mechanics.
Well, this is a point that I actually wanted to bring up for those who are listening who are not familiar with Lamentations of the Flame Princess. If you get that Rules and Magic book, which my local game store happens to stock, and thumb through it, you're going, okay, this is weird. This is billed to me as a weird fantasy role-playing game, and I flip through the rules, and I don't see anything so weird, because in your setting, the weird comes in the adventures themselves more.
Right. It's hinted in the magic and the spells in the rule book as well, and I think the art gets across that this isn't your father's fantasy role playing world or whatever you want to put.
Or don't buy this if you're 12 years old.
Yeah, don't. Well, you see, if you're a parent, you might not want your 12-year-old to see it. I personally don't care if a 12-year-old sees it. I mean, if I was 12 years old and seeing this stuff, I would have thought it was the best ever.
So, right. I stand corrected.
Yeah, the game, the weird fantasy role-playing game, it's really about your standard fantasy role-playing characters that encounter weirdness beyond standard fantasy. So the weirdness isn't baked into character creation or the rules per se. The rules just establish, you know, this is how you resolve things that might come up in the game. This is how you define your characters and, you know, what special skills and abilities they have. It doesn't say, okay, this is how weird everything is and it's baked into the rules and how you roll the dice. Because once you put that into a core rulebook, that's the new normal. It's not weird anymore. The first time you look at it, you might think, oh, wow, that's strange. But if you actually play the game, you know, the second week you're playing the game, it's normal now. So it's not weird. So there's no point in making the rule book as wild and wacky and strange and, ooh, aren't we original?
Oh, see, this is genius because this is the podcast I wanted to do with Designers and Discourses, because when you see a new game where they say, we've turned it up to 11, you're like, okay, I'm in. But if everything's turned up to 11, then 11's not 11 anymore.
Right. So the real weirdness, and I think the majesty of Lamentations of the Flame Princess comes in the source books and the adventures. Because that's where you really get it just blasted in your face, because the rules are taken care of. The rules are off to the side. Now, here is the weird shit. Here you're really into it. Anyone listening, if they want to get, if they want to get that blasted right in their face, off of LOTFP.com are linked Better Than Any Man and the Doom Cave of the Crystal-Headed Children, which were free RPG Day adventures from 2013 and 2014. And those are available now for free download, and the links are off the main website. And there's where you get the stuff. So if you want to know what's special about Lamentations of the Flame Princess, you know, look to the supplementary material. People like the rule set. They think that it's a nice, tight rule set for traditional style gaming or as a vehicle for this weirder stuff. And I'm actually surprised that the rules have caught on as they have. I'm not going to complain about it, but, you know, so it's hard for me talking about them because it almost sounds like I'm telling people not to check them out. But to me, they're not the main attraction of Lamentations. They're not where you go to see what Lamentations is all about. They're just, as it happens, a really tight and easy to use and attractive rule set that people tend to like and they've bought in the thousands, and thank you. But yeah, but you know, that's not what I consider the main event of the game.
See, we're already cooking. I can tell the nice orderly show notes are out the window because we're just going to go all over the place because you touched on something that I was going to say for later, and that free RPG Day adventure from 2013. The reason I want to bring up Better Than Any Man is that I've so far, we're only five episodes in this podcast, I've had creators on who, you know, wrote for other companies. You're a different flavor of creator because you're both creator and businessman. You're running your own business here and have to consider all the angles at once. I am in awe of what you did that one free RPG day where you ran a Kickstarter to publish a full-blown 64-page free adventure to be given away, which was Better Than Any Man in 2013, right? From the outside, that looked like pure genius.
Well, you see, the reason it looks like pure genius is because you assume I know what the hell I'm doing as a businessman. And that adventure proves I have no clue of what I'm doing as a businessman. The adventure ended up at 96 pages, by the way, not including the cover with the map inside. But yeah, that if you want to talk about Lamentations as a business and me as a businessman, the Better Than Any Man Kickstarter was a complete fiasco. It's still not delivered all its rewards.
Oh my! Well, we don't have to talk about it. I just I do think it's informative that we occasionally touch on. You know, you're both a creator. I mean, you run every facet of the business: art director, editor, publisher.
Okay. Well, I don't want to dodge. Well, we won't go in depth, but let's not dodge the issue that when it comes to timeliness and businessman-like qualities, I'm not A+. The stuff is coming. It's not a dead Kickstarter, but let's just say some of the rewards are a bit late. We'll leave it at that. But yeah, so when you say I'm both a creator and businessman, the creativity comes first. I mean, I put everything into that Better Than Any Man adventure, and maybe when a smart businessman would not have.
Well, in fairness to you, James, I mean, there are lots and lots and lots of us who have tried. I myself had a game publishing company for 1 year in 2006 and lost my ass and was back out. You know, so you have established a viable brand and a viable business. I don't want to focus on this, but I mean, you know, kudos to you for that because most creators have difficulty with this.
Yeah, well, it's the whole business. Well, the hard part is you want to do the absolute best job that you can. I would hope that's what everyone wants to do, that they're not just shoveling stuff out there because, hey, if I release X amount of product in Y amount of time, I can count on Z amount of money coming in. I like to think that everything I'm releasing is unique and awesome and top of the line and the best anyone's ever seen in gaming, which it's not going to be. Honestly, it can't be every time out, but if you have that attitude and you take the time, and when something's not working, just say, okay, you know, we have to scrap what we've got and go in a different direction. Or if you have an artist that's not delivering and but you know they're the best person for the job, yeah, if they take an extra year, I mean, that's in traditional business sense, that why would you do that? Just get someone else, get someone cheaper. But the end result is going to be so much better. And that's why, while I grit my teeth hoping, you know, the villagers aren't coming with the torches and pitchforks for the timeliness issue on some of this stuff, I'm very confident that when they actually get the stuff, any resentment is just going to go away because they're going to see the result of taking the time and making the decisions that maybe aren't crowd-pleasing at the time end up with something that is just great.
Well, this is my point exactly.
Your
typical freelance gaming writer doesn't have to be concerned about any of that. They've just got to get their manuscript, you know, decent and on time.
Yeah, well, one of the reasons I started the company is one of my early adventures, No Dignity in Death, was supposed to be done for another publisher. But when I can't remember if I'd actually submitted the manuscript or was just talking about what I wanted the book to be like. I don't remember if it had actually been delivered yet, and I was, you know, specifying, you know, have the cover look like this and have the sections, you know, looking like this and divided up this way. And he said, you do it. You have this idea. You do it and make sure it's the way you want it. And he wasn't being snarky or anything. I don't know how my tone is coming across on that, but he was right. I wanted that total control as for a total product, not just, you know, I've written some stuff. Hopefully it comes out good on the other end. So
I totally get it.
Yeah.
Well, let's we'll return to some of these issues, but let's loop it back around to just basic design intentions for Lamentations. Owning a few of the adventures in the Rules and Magic book, and I unfortunately have not had the opportunity to play in the system. I got right away that your setting, like I can already get a sense from the published adventures what your personal campaign and table are like, where it's very high risk, high reward, high lethality, which to my personal playstyle taste equals Mondo fun. Not it's not everybody's cup of tea.
Right.
Mathfinder players, hi. But how did you arrive at that? Why is that fun for you? Sell it to listeners who are like on the fence of like, why would I sign up for an adventure where the odds are, unless I play super smart, we're all getting murdered in our sleep?
Well, the selling point is, if this was real, if there were adventurers that wanted no part of, you know, normal life and society and getting a job, were going to make their fortune by going into into forbidden temples and ancient holes in the ground where they're expecting to face supernatural danger to get some money. That's horrible. That's awful. That would be the absolute... Only crazy people would do that.
So you want to role-play a gang of sociopaths. Go.
well, crazy or desperate or, you know, there's something where they're just not going to fit in normal society, or else they would be doing normal society things. And that would make for a boring game, but once you decide, okay, this is what the game is, and you stop to think for even 2 seconds, who would do this? You know, it becomes obvious that the characters themselves are, you know, a bit touched, but at the same time, once you decide to play this game, what makes that type of game fun? Well, the fact that not everyone does this, the fact that the treasure is still in there, that creature is still in the hills, means that the problem hasn't been solved because it's a difficult problem to solve. So it's going to be really dangerous. It's going to be something that normal people aren't going to go near, or they're going to get ground up. That's the adventure. That's the game. You're going into a truly hostile environment for usually not even the most noble of reasons. What would logically happen from that?
I love this, because what you're talking about is setting verisimilitude. So there's magic and fantasy, giant eagles and magic wands, but given all that, if you were going to do this, here's what would actually happen.
Yeah, I mean, of course, you know, it's not the only thing that can happen, but it makes sense to me, and as a guiding principle, I guess you can call it, you know, it does seem to work. It does seem to resonate with people. And yeah. And once you establish that, you can do absolutely anything. There are no limits. I mean, if I wanted to do a rather traditional, you know, Dungeons and Dragons flavor adventure that has no particular weird elements, is just some standard stuff, I could still do it. But I don't think you could, you know, Wizards of the Coast isn't going to publish anything like Death, Love, Doom.
Right.
Or like Better Than Any Man, for that matter. So, you know, the freedom to absolutely do anything is great. And it, yeah. And you can only really do anything once you establish you're willing to get nasty. Well, but the important thing is to not be nasty every time, because then you actually keep people guessing, which causes its own problems because, you know, people whine and complain they want to know exactly what they're getting when they buy something, but you can't please everyone.
Well, allow me to compliment you on the rule set itself, because it's extraordinarily rules light, but it's also rules tight. It's just now I'm making it sound like it's like Ten Commandments on a tablet. It's not that it's Spartan, but it's really, really tight rule set.
Yeah. Well, thank you.
I mean, that's a standard old school trait, so it's almost to be expected in the larger family of games we're talking about, yeah. But you did a really, really nice job.
Yes, thank you. spent a lot of money to hide the imperfections there.
You obviously arrived at the choice to write it that way. How did that happen?
Yeah. Well, because the thing is, the way you're talking though is that I managed to make it that concise, and I don't consider myself a designer per se. I'm more a terraformer. I'm taking a planet that's already there and changing it to suit my needs. So when you say that I made something that's tight and concise, I don't think it's necessarily any tighter or more concise, certainly not more than, say, Holmes D&D or the old Moldvay basic set. So I'm just really working from the traditions of people that went before me.
You actually started with Redbox D&D, is that right?
Redbox, yes, Mentzer, yeah.
So yeah. What you've done is, I mean, it's not, you didn't copy Redbox, but you've done very much what Frank did with that edition of the game, in my opinion.
Okay.
Where it's nice and concise.
Yeah, thank you. That's,
and those are design decisions, because you could have just as easily spiraled it up into first edition AD&D, you know, and made it 400 pages of rules.
Yeah, I could have, but it's not any great design capability or insight to decide go for Mentzer instead of straight Gygax. I mean, that's a decision, but that's, I don't know, I don't see it as great innovation or anything.
Well, you know, I appreciate your humility on this subject, but these are things that you did sit down and decide to do, and in the spirit of every creator, you wrote it the way you'd enjoy dealing with it.
Yeah, that's fair. I made the decision to put some artwork that you can't unsee in there. I decided in the latest version of the rules to have a big section on firearms and have a lot of technical illustrations on that. So, you know, there are decisions I make, but the actual core of the system, you know, it's not mine. So it's hard for me to talk like, oh, yes, I did this and that, and yes, that's why you should be interested in what I did. It's when you're talking about the actual core rules of it, I don't feel like I should own it in that way.
I appreciate what you're saying. I mean, we to the extent that in 2015 we can write stuff like this, we're standing on the shoulders of other giants. That's what you're saying.
Well, you see, now I got a problem with that. I have a problem with saying the shoulders of giants, because, you know, Gary, you know, for example, Gary Gygax is a great man in the industry, but, you know, he's just a man, you know, and you know, a few years back at a convention in Helsinki, you know, I had dinner with Frank Mentzer and Eric Mona from Paizo. And these are, you know, great men in the industry. Paizo is huge and Mentzer is Mentzer. But, you know, I was like the junior member of the industry at the table. But I wasn't looking at these people thinking, oh, giants. I'm looking at this people thinking, you know, how, you know, when I'm Mentzer's age, how do I get to be in his position where, you know, the junior people are wanting to flock to me? And so when you say shoulders of giants, that really implies that you can never stand as tall as they did. And it's like being in a band and thinking, oh, I'm never going to be as good as Black Sabbath. Then, you know, what? Stop! You know, yes, you can be. You know, you can be just as big, just as important, just as huge as your idols. They're just people who did stuff. You're a person who did stuff. Yes, respect them for what they've done. Yes, acknowledge all of the things that they did so you don't have to. But in the end, for the people that come after you, you can be just as big as they were. So don't sell yourself short. Do what you can. And don't act like other people are hotter shit than you if you actually have ideas and do things that you believe in. You can be everything.
I agree with you 100%, and forgive my ill-chosen metaphor that sent you off on that tangent, because I didn't mean to. I mean, I get it, because Mutant Car Classics that I've written is no more original than let's take Gamma World and rewrite it for the Dungeon Crawl Classics rule set. You know, so I have certainly brought a great deal of my original thinking and, you know, those little flavor settings, just like you did with Flame Princess. But, you know, how original is it? Well, if it weren't for Gygax Arneson and James Ward and Joseph Goodman, it wouldn't be there. That's all I meant.
Well, yeah, but certainly, you know, however I'll be remembered in role-playing games, it's not going to be for how I decided, you know, you should roll up a character. I mean, that's obviously not where I'm going to become, you know, whatever fame I'll end up getting. But, you know, there's got to be something I'm doing right at this point. And hopefully it's something that I continue to build on to where, you know, Lamentations isn't that thing that happened in the 2010s, you know, hopefully in 20, 30 years, God, you know, I'll be getting the chauffeur treatment when going to a convention instead of having to lug 5 bags through the airport myself. But, well, you know, the idea is that it will, you know, as of right now, of course, people can stop being interested at any time, but I still have big plans. They're going to take years to finish. From this point, you know, I just signed some people to do new large-scale source books that certainly aren't going to be coming out in 2016. So there is an ongoing plan, and there is something for Lamentations to keep being more than it is. So, yeah.
Well, the proof is in the pudding. We'll drop every episode there's a list of links mentioned in the show, and obviously the homepage for Lamentations of Flame Princess will be one of those. And all you have to do is browse the store and see this is an expanding franchise. I hate that.
Well,
word,
right
franchise,
now, if you go to the store, you're just going to see the T-shirts in all the different sizes. So, you know, click on the print filter in the upper left corner of the site homepage. But, or, you know, get some shirts. That's good, too. But
or get on your brick and mortar, you know, store owner to carry this stuff. I'm very fortunate that here in Cincinnati we have a guy who's on top of it. That's how I got your stuff.
In Cincinnati, you say?
Cincinnati, Ohio. That's where we're broadcasting from. Seven time zones away from Helsinki.
Yes. I think Cincinnati. I might be wrong. I might be confusing this, but I do believe Cincinnati is where I had my biggest problems with Better Than Any Man. Where a local game store owner saw it and just chucked it out.
You know, under any other circumstances, I would not want to discuss this, but that game store just went out of business. And you're right. I was an eyewitness. I was in the store when all that went on.
Awesome. Awesome.
2013 free RPG day. The owner of Yada Quest, which just closed this past year, went berserk that Lamentations of Flame Princess was included in this stuff. And again, this was something I was going to talk about later in the episode, but I'm the kind of guy, like, if you don't like it, don't buy it.
Yeah, oh man, that I have mixed feelings about that, because on one hand, what a dick. On the second hand, that is the best publicity ever.
Right. He got so angry about that he didn't participate in the following free RPG day over it, and that's what sent me to the game store I now patronage.
Awesome, because, and I heard in other locations that, you know, when people were looking at it, you know, the table where they were giving away the free RPG day stuff, the employees were, you know, like warning people, oh, be careful with that one. I mean, how cool is that?
Well, we're so not doing the show notes now. So, but let's go ahead and talk about that, because I mean, the game is billed as for 18 and over, so it's not like you know, you're marketing the game. It's not like you have Joe Camel billboards marketing the game to kids. So to what
I'm not officially marketing the game to kids, but you know, the 18 plus is just to cover my ass. But honestly, if a 15 or 16 year old that's into heavy metal or watches even crappy PG-13 horror movies gets hold of this stuff, you know, who cares? I don't care. You know, it's just the 18 plus is just a notice that, you know, there's going to be some odd things inside. Be advised. Anyone of any age who looks at that and is curious is not going to be harmed by what they find inside. And the people that are a bit, ooh, well, maybe not, well, then they should stay away. But in the end, it's just nonsense words and pictures. You know, nothing's going to reach out and stab you, so I don't get why anyone gives a shit on that level.
What's interesting to me about this is, I'll grant you, I personally couldn't pass for, you know, normal average street level person in my views of these things. But when I looked at Lamentations of the Flame Princess, instead of being offended by any explicit content, I noticed that there are strong female protagonists featured in bunches of the cover art.
Yeah, that's not real. Well, I'll say right now, that's not done to make any sort of point or to be a shield against any other elements that are in the game or artwork. There's a couple things going on there. Number one, whenever some movie or TV show is released that's got a strong female protagonist and everyone loses their shit, like this is the most weird, unusual thing they've ever seen or witnessed. That, oh my God, it's a capable woman in a movie. What are we going to do? Oh, you know, people are either falling all over themselves thinking that, you know, this is awesome. Why isn't everything like this? Or they're being stupid saying, I can't watch a movie with a woman that can beat up a man. You know, I don't get it either way. You know, I grew up in a, you know, single parent household. My mother was the authority figure. Vast majority of all my teachers through school were women. I'm trying to think, most of my bosses in my working life have been women. So the idea of a woman as a, like, well, as an authority figure, as a strong person, that's, I mean, it's not news to me. It's like
as a kick-ass fighter mage, you know?
Well, yeah, I mean, well, so the idea of a strong woman isn't special to begin with. It, to me, is normal, everyday, run-of-the-mill, you know, and so on that level, you know, why not? On the other level, I am now a 41-year-old overweight guy, you know, and married, you know, and you know, what business do I have talking to younger, prettier girls? Absolutely none. So this is one way to invent a reason. All of the recurring characters, you know, there is a real life reference model that I, you know, talk to and discuss and, you know, come up with art ideas and clear things with. It gives me an excuse to talk to people that aren't gaming people, that aren't my age, that are, you know, it's some sort of, you know, greater social lifeline as well. And yeah, so that's what those two things are. That's what that is. It's those two things.
Well, I find that interesting because I'm a number of years older than you and hang out with Tim Kask, who's a number of years older than me, and we're actively writing in the industry. And I don't know how you're my age and do that without socializing with younger people. So you know what's going on.
Well,
even if it's no more just getting a sense of what your audience wants.
I don't care what my audience wants.
Oh, okay. All right.
Yeah. The socializing I do, I mean, even with the gamers, let's face it. Most of the gamers I know, I don't want them anywhere near a cover of a book.
Well, okay. All right. Well, let me rephrase. Let me take another run at this because, we haven't really talked much about the inspirations that inform your work. And
okay.
And just as one of those examples, you know, you're talking about drawing inspiration for the work for Lamentation of the Flame Princess by, you know, social contact with younger people.
No. That's not what I'm saying. That this scheme of how I do the cover art and having these recurring characters gives me an excuse to socialize outside of what would otherwise be my normal social circles.
I see.
It's not like I'm, and the idea of, you know, when I talk about getting ideas, because there's a real person behind the characters, they have to be okay with how I portray the characters. And I want to make sure they're happy. So I ask them, is there any, you know, how would you like to see this character? Do you have any ideas? Because, for example, I've had one of the reference models quit and say she doesn't want to do it anymore, no more art. And, you know, I don't like that. So anything I could do to keep them happy, to where when they get a book and there's something in there where they're happy that their likeness has been used. So I'm getting some artwork ideas, but for overall content and everything, these people aren't really contributing in that way.
But it is a source of inspiration.
Yeah. It's difficult to say because it's so easy for me to get really skeevy talking about this.
Well, we'll just move on to the more obvious sources of inspiration, like death metal music.
Okay.
And the album art that accompanies that. I know that's been a big influence on you.
Yeah, I was not really big into music at all when I was younger. I mean, there were some things I would like, usually various forms of pop music, certain songs here and there I'd want to tape off the radio. But I never had like a big record collection or anything until I started getting into heavy metal. It was senior year of high school. Metallica had just released the Black Album, Guns N' Roses, the Use Your Illusion albums. And I started listening, getting into that sort of stuff. But I didn't have a social circle for that at the time because, you know, I was geek nerd kid in high school. And the people that listened to heavy metal were the bad people who like smoked in the bathrooms and shit, you know. So I had no cultural touch points. It was just MTV that was getting me into things for shame. And then one night on Headbangers Ball, there was the Triple Thrash Threat. And there was Megadeth and Slayer. And then Napalm Death had a video. And when I saw this, listened to this Napalm Death video, it didn't sound like a band. It didn't sound like music. It was like a force of nature. And I was like, whoa, I've got to see what the hell that is. And luckily, the local record store, you know, had the latest Napalm Death album. And just 45 minutes of just this blasting, and Napalm Death is a, you know, a very left political kind of band.
Right on.
Yeah, so, you know, Napalm Death is like anti-war protest kind of name. And then, you know, I learned about record labels that deal with this stuff. The Thanks List had a bunch of other bands. So I would just experiment and see, oh, this band in the record store is in this Thanks List. I'd get this, and then I'd cross-list the Thanks List. It was several years after that before I found out that, you know, there were magazines that wrote about music. So I was really out of the loop. But, you know, so really discovering this, having no, you know, seeing a video on MTV and then going and doing the research yourself and discovering all this stuff and finding out there's this whole world of creation and art that you just had no idea about. And everything's new. And it's, you know, I'm 17, 18 years old at the time, but I'm absorbing all this stuff like I'm a real little kid again. Like, oh my God, this is all so great and so new. And that really creates an impression. All that, you know, early 90s death metal stuff and the artwork and the fact that these bands would do things that they know that they would never get any sort of mainstream success. You know, the best that they could hope for is being played at MTV once a week at 1 a.m. And yet they're doing it because that's what they believe in. And it's
so I imagine the joy you experienced at this discovery and exploration mirrored the same feelings you had when you discovered role-playing games.
Yeah, really. Yeah, what was I, 8, 9 years old at the time? My mother actually introduced me because I think she just wanted to paint the miniatures. that's what I really believe it was all about. But yeah, then discovering this, and then you can make things and do anything, and oh my God, look at these adventures that you can play, and you know, and then you find out that the world thinks that this means Satanism and killing yourself. And then, you know, my mother wasn't happy about that. She made me watch Mazes and Monsters as if it was some sort of documentary. And so this role-playing thing, even when TSR is making millions and millions of dollars, it still feels like it's this outside forbidden thing. And I think that has an impact with how I behave now, because that was the age when, you know, police officers would come to the school to warn about satanic cults. And, oh, it's D&D and heavy metal that'll get you into it. At that time, I didn't know anything about heavy metal, but I knew about D&D, and I knew it wasn't what they were telling me that it was. So right there, you learn to distrust law enforcement, you learn to distrust school authority, the news media, because there's this one thing you know about that the media is just lying about, that the person with the badge is lying to you about. And that's really an education in and of itself. When you first learn that, and if you learn that young, that's going to skew you forever. And it wasn't D&D that did that. It
kids
was the asshole lying about it.
Kids are always smarter than the adults think they are. And I can remember being on both sides of the fence. So the heavy metal music, walk us through the heavy metal music and the underground horror movies informing your approach to your personal role-playing game.
Well, it's, you know, what happens when monsters get a hold of people? What happens when a knife slices flesh? I mean, of course that's applicable to role-playing games. That's what happens in the role-playing games. Sure, in most role-playing games, you're just abstracting it with hit points, and, you know, it's just, you roll a die, okay, you lose 5 hit points. Well, what does that mean? What happens in the game if you were that character, and you got hit for X amount of damage by some monster with acid-dripping claws? What would that actually look like? What would that actually feel like? So I really don't think that in that respect, it's being explicit with what has just traditionally been abstracted in role-playing. You know, what does it mean when your character dies from you know, some acidic slime? It's awful. It's just the worst. Can you imagine a worse death than being one of the victims in the blob?
No, I can't.
No, and that's standard expected hazard to any dungeon-crawling adventurer. That's the least of your worries. It's something that's known and cataloged. That's not even the stuff you're afraid of because you know it's there. Yet, that's what it is. So it's like the horror movies and that type of heavy metal. It's just exposing a reality that has kind of been hidden.
Well, I don't want to go back into the politics of this, but this is a basic human need to explore the horror of situations in a rehearsed fashion. That's a basic psychological need everyone has to different levels.
And I think a lot of what a lot of my critics miss is this stuff does freak me out. I mean, you watch The Blob, and it's one of the rare cases where the later remake, I think, is the best one. The 1988 remake, I think it was.
Oh, I know exactly what you mean, and I agree.
Yeah, I mean, that one, I mean, when you're a kid, 1988, I would have been 13 when that movie came out. When you're at that age and you're watching a horror movie and they kill a kid, that movie is the most real thing on earth at that point, because you just don't kill kids in horror movies. That's not something that's done. Not not a lot. So once you see that happen, you know, the whole thing suddenly feels more realistic. Anything can happen. And maybe it won't. Usually it won't, but you've established, you create real suspense because nothing, absolutely nothing is off the table. And once you get people believing that, you've got them. They'll follow you anywhere just to find out what happens because they don't know. And that's the cool thing about, you know, death metal. Musically, it's like that. Once you establish that you're willing to do a blast beat, once you establish that your singing is just this guttural snarl, most bands will just leave it at that, and it'll be 50 minutes of and that'll be boring. But the bands that use that as a springboard to experiment, that's the greatest thing ever. I mean, it's...
Well, see, now we have squared the circle by coming all the way back around to what you've done with Lamentations of the Flame Princess. Yeah. Which is not... The point of the game is not to, you know, be as horrible in the setting as possible.
Well, that's the job of the adventurers to create a horrible situation, but it doesn't guarantee, or maybe not even probable, that the horrible things will happen. You're just establishing the game can go there.
But the point it's not the setting is not there to be of itself. The setting is there to be a springboard for the adventure.
Yes. That, you know, if everything goes well and the players, you know, avoid their worst fates and the thing doesn't become a giant clusterfuck, it doesn't mean the game has failed. It just means that, you know, something different happened this time. You know, a different possibility, made itself real. And then there are going to be times where it does get just, you know... The kind of sessions where everyone just kind of hang their head at the end and someone says, "We done? We go home?" You know, you can go either way. You don't know. It's not pre-programmed to give you any sort of expected ending.
I mean, we're talking in some part about playstyle preference, but I'm in your camp where a TPK and a party wipe can be the most uproarious fun you ever have around the table if you're doing it right.
Yeah, well, that's the thing. I think in a lot of ways, role-playing designers are comedy writers. Because if you're doing, you know, you can have a total beer and pretzels game where everyone, you know, you assume everyone's just joking around the table anyway. But if you try to do a really epic storyline in your gaming, you know, it'll oftentimes just not end up like the DM of the Rings webcomic, where everyone just ends up laughing at it anyway. If you try to do something really important and socially conscious, it doesn't mean the players aren't going to, you know, they're still going to say something from Monty Python and everyone's going to start laughing anyway. And even with the stuff I do, the more horrible and awful and just shit things that are happening in game, the more people around the table tend to laugh. Yeah, the more they're just losing their minds, laughing their asses off. So it's not like here present awful things in the game so everybody can be really grim and morbid around the table. That doesn't happen. I mean, it might happen that things are tense before they find out what's going to happen, you know, before they find out the results of what they're doing. But once that actually happens, the tension is released, it really doesn't matter if it's victory or total disaster. That the release of tension will come out as fun.
I love this because, and this is why it's my opinion that role-playing game adventure writing is a tougher call for an author than straight fiction. Because what you're trying to do when you're writing these adventures is create a multi-tiered, it could go any direction situation that results in the same dramatic arcs. But you don't fill it out the other end of the arc. The players do.
Yeah. Yeah, that's what makes it easy, because if you're writing an actual story, you have to worry about plot and pacing and characterization and all this crap that you just don't have to worry about. In an adventure, you really have to do situation. That's what you have to do. You have to make a situation that's open-ended. There's your adventure writing. You know, everything else on top is just spice on top of that. Just come up with an interesting, open-ended situation, and that's the core of adventure writing.
Well, James, this has been such a great conversation, and I'm sorry that we've run out of time, but thank you so much for coming on the show.
Yes, I'll be interested in finding out how you edit this.
But I think we got a great show.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, it's difficult to sit here and say, yes, people will enjoy what I said immensely. But yeah, it felt good. Didn't feel too canned. That's usually my problem with these podcast interviews. The questions are very generic and very canned, but at least with your podcast, it has a point. It's not just talking with people. You have things you want to talk about, which is good. Usually I get on podcasts and they're boring. The questions are boring.
Well, I really appreciate you taking the time out of your schedule to do this. And if you'd like to write the show and comment on tonight's episode, or to suggest future guests, you can write us at designers@mudpuppygames.com. And that'll wrap it up for this episode of Designers and Discourses. We'll see you all next time.